Good morning. Thanks for coming out here. My name is Alexander Hurtle Fernandez. I'm a researcher here at the Economic Policy Institute, specializing in social insurance and young adult economic issues. I'm really pleased to welcome you all here to this forum today to discuss the economic barriers that unpaid internships create, especially for low-income students, and potential policy solutions that the government can implement to ensure access for all students, regardless of their background, to these valuable opportunities. This is actually the first event in an ongoing research series here at EPI on young adult economic issues, and I'm really happy that we're collaborating with Campus Progress and Demos on this event and brief. I want to give a special thanks to all the interns, especially the unpaid ones, who made it out here today. I promise to keep my introduction remarks brief because I know just how short all of your lunch breaks are. Before I begin, I just want to acknowledge the help and support and patience of all the staff here at EPI, at Demos, and at Campus Progress that have worked together to publish this brief and to put on the event today. This is Catherine's and I's first time doing this sort of thing, so we're really, really appreciative of all of your patience and support. For Catherine and I, this project is really a labor of love. We were inspired to work on this issue because we both know we wouldn't be here in front of you without our unpaid internships. I was an intern here at EPI not 2 years ago, and that's the direct reason why I'm employed today. But while I was fortunate enough to receive financial support during my time here as an intern at EPI, many students do not. According to a national survey conducted by InternBridge, a private consultancy, only 1 in 3 internships at nonprofit organizations is paid. While the rate for government agencies is a little bit higher at 50%, it is still substantially lower than the rate of 70% for interns at for-profit organizations. As the panelists will discuss today, that so many public service internships in governments and nonprofits are unpaid creates a serious obstacle for low-income students, not only in obtaining these internships and doing these internships, but securing employment in these organizations after graduation. It's for this reason that we've come up with a system of financial supports to provide low-income students with subsidies to pursue these internships in public service organizations. Now I'll introduce the panelists in order of their presentations today. I'll keep their bios brief, as I think you all have longer descriptions that do them far better justice than I'll do coming up. First up is Nancy Kalfin, Director of the Economic Opportunity Program at Demos. Nancy has spent nearly 2 decades researching and analyzing policies related to family economic security. Her recent research focuses on post-secondary school access and completion for low-income youth. Next, we'll have Shirley Sagawa, visiting fellow at the Center for American Progress and a leading expert on youth economic policy and national service. Shirley will discuss the role of the government in promoting public service amongst disadvantaged youth and is really uniquely qualified to discuss this theme as an integral designer of both AmeriCorps and the Corporation for National Service. And after her will be my co-conspirator, Catherine Edwards. Catherine joined EPI in 2008 and works on state-level economic issues and, most importantly, young adult economic issues. Catherine will outline the policy proposal that we detail at fuller length in your briefs. Finally, we're fortunate enough to have Cassie Phillips, who will be coming and joining the panel in a little bit. She's a 2007 graduate of Duke University and is a former unpaid intern herself. She'll discuss her firsthand experiences dealing with the financial burden of unpaid work. After the panelists give their presentations, we'll open up the floor for questions from the audience. So without further ado, Dr. Kalfin from Demos.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for taking time to be with us here today. I want to talk a little bit about the context in which this proposal that we're going to talk about for paid internships is situated. Over the last 30 years or so, we've seen the opportunity structure for young adults change dramatically. And I want to start by talking about what's happened with higher education. Since the 1960s, we've really seen a revolution in access to higher education, in part because of the GI Bill after World War II, the Higher Education Act of 1965. These policies and others allowed low and moderate income young people access, widespread access to college for the first time. And we really saw rates of college graduates go up considerably. I'm one of those people who benefited from all of those policies. I came from a struggling middle-income family. I was able to get student loans for 3% and 4% interest back in the days of hyperinflation, when you could put money in your savings account and get 5% interest, and you know, a car loan would be 10% interest or more. And yet I was able to borrow money at 3% and 4%. I qualified for work study. I graduated from a state university with some debt, but a reasonable amount that I was able to pay off in my 20s. And I also entered a job market that was very different from the one we have today. And when I was going to school, internships were just not part of the college experience. I mean, it was the rare person, and primarily at elite private schools, who had internships, and they certainly weren't considered a necessary prerequisite to getting a job. But all that's changed. And not only are internships considered an essential part of the college experience and preparation for the job market, you know, it puts students without internships at a considerable disadvantage in what is already a horrendous job market for young people. So what I want to do is tell you a little bit more about why this proposal is so important and why now, given everything that's going on in higher education and the challenges facing young adults more generally. Over the last 30 years, college access has actually improved dramatically. So nearly 70% of high school students go on immediately to some form of post-secondary education. And another thing that's important about this access is that college access has improved across income levels, across race and ethnicity, although whites and higher income students have still benefited disproportionately. But despite these really steady, you know, you look at the charts and it's just steady growth in enrollment, college graduation rates have been flat for 30 years. And the percent of, if you look at young adults ages 25 to 29 with a bachelor's degree, that percentage has remained at about 30% for the last decade. So more young people are enrolling in college, but they're not graduating. And this has obvious implications for U.S. competitiveness in the global economy. I mean, we've fallen internationally in terms of our position in higher education. And, you know, as we all know, vast inequities continue to exist in who gets a college degree and who doesn't. And the most striking difference continues to have to do with economic privilege, which, of course, is related to racial and ethnic disparities as well. So young people from the most privileged socioeconomic backgrounds, those with the most highly educated parents and with the highest family incomes, are 8 times more likely to earn a bachelor's degree in their mid-20s than their peer from the least privileged backgrounds. And there are a lot of reasons for this, but financial constraints are one of the major things going on. And what we're finding is that graduating from college is actually becoming much more difficult than it was for low-income students, and a lot of the gains that were made are eroding. A couple of things that explain that. States have really cut back on their support for higher education, but financial aid policies have changed dramatically too. So tuition has skyrocketed, and at the same time, federal financial aid has shifted away from grants. More emphasis, more of the money is given in loans than before, a larger share. The purchasing power of Pell Grants, the nation's largest source of need-based financial aid, has really declined. So they used to cover about three-quarters of the cost of going attending a state university, and now that's less than a third. Of course, the student aid provisions and the reconciliation bill will change that a little bit. But trends at state and institutional levels have been even worse. So what we've seen is a shift from need-based aid to merit-based aid. And so more and more institutions are giving aid to attract the best prepared students, i.e. the students who would go to college anyway. So financial aid has I just came back from vacation. Has moved away from its original purpose of opening up access in terms of affordability. And in a recent report that we did at Demos, which I believe is out there on the table, Work Less, Study More, and Succeed, my colleague and I found that one of the biggest factors in the completion problem are the financial constraints. Students enroll, more students are working. Three-quarters of bachelor's degree students are employed. Almost half of them are employed more than 20 hours a week, and a considerable number are actually working full-time. So what we see for students is a vicious cycle. They work more to earn more money. Sometimes it negatively impacts their grades. They have to lower their course load, go part-time, that stretches out how long it takes them to get their degree. And so a lot of people are dropping out, giving up, and not getting their degrees. We know that students who earn a bachelor's degree on average graduate with $23,000 in student loan debt. And much less talked about is the fact that a lot of these folks who enroll but never graduate are leaving school with a considerable amount of student loan debt, too. And so you add that on top of the job market, jobs not paying as much, not less likely to offer health benefits, retirement benefits, and it means that young people are getting off to a really rough start. So this proposal is incredibly important because it does a number of things. It helps to address the financial barriers for college attendance, but it also provides this valuable experience and makes that college degree more valuable on the job market. Young people of all backgrounds are struggling these days, but obviously this is particularly important for low-income students. So I think this proposal could be quite an important step for starting to help level the playing field in higher education.
Great. Thanks, Nancy. Next, we'll have Shirley to speak on the role of government in encouraging public service for low-income youth.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me. I was really excited to get this invitation because I remember when I was in college, which was an extremely long time ago, writing an editorial for my college paper about why internships ought to be paid, you know, having done the sort of Washington internship myself. And I have to say, it's led to every other job that I've ever had, that one internship in 1981. Raise your hand if you've ever gotten a job because somebody you knew helped, told you about it and recommended you, you know, some connection. Okay, so this is why we need to do this, right? Because everything about economic opportunity, and, you know, you can start that from down in much lower grade levels, the kind of exposure that somebody needs to be able to move really out of poverty and into a job that pays a decent wage and especially if you want want to move into a position of any influence so that you can change the circumstances of the world, those social capital connections are absolutely fundamental, and we do so little to address it. And it's time we think about it. So this is a tremendously good time to be exploring this particular policy topic. We're at a huge, we're on the edge of a huge labor shortage in some fields we probably care a lot about. Public health is expecting to experience a 250,000 slot labor shortage over the next few years. The nonprofit sector is going to lose 50% of its current leaders as the boomers retire. 50%. You know, who are going to take the place of these folks? You know, you can go across the board, social work, teaching, nursing, you know, there's any career that you think of that's probably not, you know, top of the pay scale, but is absolutely critical to our society being just, functioning fairly, keeping people healthy, and making it a good place to live, our country a good place to live. We're not going to have those people unless we consciously pay attention to it. That's what makes this a matter of public policy. AmeriCorps is one of the solutions to this problem, and just to give you a little background on AmeriCorps. I did help to start the program 15 years ago, I guess. And we really thought, right now, AmeriCorps is both full-time and part-time opportunities for service. It encompasses both direct service types of positions as well as those that we think of as capacity building, helping to make nonprofits more effective, recruit volunteers, raise money. It engages, the president's budget for 2011 would engage a little over 100,000 people. So it's not enough. But the program, what's good about the program, and it is open to most of the people who serve in AmeriCorps are sort of the, you know, 18 to 30 age range, but it's open to any adult. It pays a modest stipend. The minimum that you can be paid is basically the poverty level for a single person, and then it can go up to twice that in terms of what. And again, you're not going to get rich off this program, but it's thought to be enough to live on. And the other thing I want to call attention to is that AmeriCorps members get health insurance. Full-time members get health insurance. They get an education award that they can use, which is approximately, for a full-time person, it's approximately what a Pell Grant is for a year. You also get child care benefits. So the reason all those benefits are wrapped into the program, and it does make it a little more expensive than sometimes people in Congress would like, is precisely so you can participate if you're a lower income person. If we didn't have those benefits, it would become another opportunity that, you know, upper middle class and wealthy people can give their young children the chance to go see the poor. Well, that's not what this is about. This is about everybody working together to solve America's problems. So it's really fundamentally important that the single working mom and the, you know, kid who's, you know, working on his GED and the, you know, people who live in low income urban communities and people in the rural areas, that they all can participate. It's if it's the American National Service Program, it can't just be for wealthy people. And some of these positions would really, you know, I would equate them to internships in terms of the opportunities that they present. So, for example, the Community Health Corps is run by the National Association of Community Health Centers, and people are placed in community health centers all over the country, and they do that part of the healthcare system that isn't getting paid for by the insurance. So it's going to help you navigate the system. It's the AmeriCorps members are going to, you know, help you do preventive and maintain, you know, address chronic conditions and your lifestyle changes. It's going to, you know, help with case management. It's going to call people, make sure they come to appointments. They're going to provide transportation. They're going to work in communities to make them healthier. So all those kinds of things that we know we want to see to make our communities healthier, that's what AmeriCorps members do in community health corps. And 60% of people who serve in that program go on to careers in public health, right? So that's a good marriage of a need to address a shortage and create opportunities for people from all different backgrounds to serve. LISC, which many of you, I'm sure, have heard of, the community development groups, also has an AmeriCorps program that they use to bring new people into the system. VISTA is a long-standing program, I think one of the best programs, best-kept secrets, and again, it's a full-time opportunity to work in a nonprofit, help build its capacity, and really change the equation in communities. So I will leave it there, and just to say that AmeriCorps is terrific and a part of the solution, but it's not the only solution. You can't serve in AmeriCorps and be in an advocacy organization. You can't get placed in a government agency for the most part. There's a lot of limitations on where AmeriCorps placements can be, and as I said, the president's budget would only support a little over 100,000, and think of how many people need this opportunity. So while I urge everyone to be supportive of expanding the program, we do need other things like the proposal that we're going to hear more about.
Thanks, Shirley. And now we turn it over to Catherine for the wonky details of how our proposal would actually work.
Thanks, Alex. Internships have become a standard component of a college graduate's resume. They, as we've already said, they're an opportunity to learn new skills, to try out certain industries or professions, network, and meet professionals in a field of interest. In short, internships provide the bridge between education and the labor market. And when I say that they're a crucial bridge, I'm by no means overstating their importance. A Michigan State University survey from 2007 found that half of all college graduate hires had previously interned at the firm at which they were hired. A separate survey from the National Association of Colleges and Employers found that 76% of firms reported relevant work experience as the primary factor when making hiring decisions. Now, the idea of an entry-level job has really become a misnomer, as workers are expected to bring more to the table before they've even started working. In the wake of a recession and the resulting competitive labor market, it would seem that a system that connects students with employers should be promoted and not criticized. If internships are key to getting a good job, then we should encourage students to get them. At the same time, however, internships must be rethought of in the context of inequalities they either perpetuate or create. In spite of their value, the choice to take an internship is often limited by a student's economic resources. As we've said before, the vast majority of nonprofit and governmental internships are unpaid. For a student of modest means, this price tag is often too great. Unpaid internships are out of reach for many low-income students, a result of the high cost of foregoing wages and financing a living without a paycheck. For example, we estimate that a three-month internship in DC could conservatively cost $4,000. Now, to put that number in context, for a family living at the poverty line, that's roughly a fifth of their family's annual income. It's hard to imagine how a student from that background would be able to afford an unpaid internship in DC. So the result is an intern pool that's skewed by income status, in which unpaid internships recruit not only from the best and brightest, but from those most able to afford it. Our goal, as modest as it may sound, is to redefine the game, to change the playing field for students who want to do internships in public service. And to that end, we propose a new initiative of the Student Opportunity Program. Our program would provide financial support for low-income college students who choose to pursue summer or semester-long internships in nonprofit organizations or government agencies. So, how would this work and what would it look like? Well, it would look a lot like a financial aid stipend, because that's essentially what we're proposing. Uniform grants of $3,500 for 3 months and $7,000 for 6 month internships, with $1,000 cost of living adjustment if you happen to have an internship in a very expensive city. Now, for administration, we propose using the Federal Work Study Program to screen students and administer grants. Work Study provides aid to college students through part-time employment. It is a system that targets need-based students and as determined by the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, more commonly known as FAFSA. It selects need-based students and connects them with work opportunities, which is essentially what we want to do with internships. So for the Student Opportunity Program, funding would go through and be administered by these work study offices. This has many advantages. First, it capitalizes on existing resources and administrative infrastructure, an infrastructure that exists at over 3,400 campuses around the country and is familiar to hundreds of thousands of students. But most importantly, it gives individual campuses the freedom to design their own student opportunity program. The only federally mandated eligibility requirement is income. All students must lie below 300% of the federal poverty line, which in 2009 was roughly $66,000. And in terms of the composition of students who go to college, that represents a little under half who would be eligible to apply. After this FAFSA test, however, colleges are left with considerable discretion to select their own students and design their own program. And of course, the amount that each campus would receive for the Student Opportunity Program would be directly proportional to the number of low-income students they have who are receiving financial aid, which makes sense because the more low-income students you have, the more funding for low-income students you should get. It's by using existing systems like FAFSA and like work-study that the program is able to boast a relatively low administrative cost and a high return in reach. For an initial $500 million, we estimate that the Student Opportunity Program would provide support for 100,000 interns. Our goal, though, is to scale up and to increase the program each year until we reach 500,000 internships, or roughly one-fifth of all income-eligible students. This would cost about $1.5 to $2 billion per year, but the program would be funded entirely by reforms of the tax expenditures currently offered for higher education, namely by combining the HOPE and Lifetime Learning Credit. This was a policy option that was originally reviewed by the Congressional Budget Office. So for those of you who want the budget nitty-gritty, I would encourage you to look at our reports and find a detailed look. But in the interest of time and the general interest of the group, I won't get too much into the weeds on that, only to say that it would raise revenues by $16.4 billion over the 10-year budget window, which is the cost of the Student Opportunity Program. Now, I should say that while the headline benefit is 500,000 students a year who pursue internships in public service, the winners here are the employers, who get access to a broader pool of applicants where income is less of a determinant. And before I stop, I'll also say this. Opportunity is not always a given. We see in many examples of our society the differences between the haves and the have-nots, the cans and the cannots, or in this case, those who have the income cushion to do more and those who don't. Our program is not an equalizer. It's not a catch-all fix to the dismal outlook for the youth labor market, nor should it be. Internships are bridges, and we can make them better.
Great. Thanks, Catherine. And now we're fortunate enough to have Cassie, who is here really briefly on her lunch break, which I think is only half an hour, so we're very grateful to have you here, to talk about her own experiences as an unpaid intern.
Hi, thanks for having me and for Catherine and Alex for organizing this. I guess I've been asked to kind of put a face or a case study look at the issues that these women have spoken about through my own personal experience, and I wanted to start off by just giving you a little bit of, I guess, what I've done. Is that better? Okay. And I also want to point out that what I'm about to share, I mean, while I might represent a woman and a minority coming from a middle-class family, I would say that my story is not unique to just these groups, and I'm sure there's plenty of people in the room and all around Washington that have maybe similar stories. So I attended public school all the way through high school, and then when it came time to go to college, you know, you have the trade-off between, well, are you going to go to a state school, out-of-state school, whatever, and there's lots of different things to consider in terms of opportunity and cost. In the end, I decided to go to Duke University because education is an investment, and I did make an investment in it, and I graduated with sizable student debt, which I knew coming out that was one of the things that I had considered and weighed. And while I so I have three different kinds of, I guess, student debt: federal loans, so two types, and private loans. And while I was an undergrad, I did an unpaid internship at an organization here in Washington, and then upon graduating, I had an internship on Capitol Hill, and all of these were unpaid. And I guess what I found was, I studied public policy, so a lot of people encouraged me to work on the Hill because they said it would be a great experience, and from talking with people who have jobs on the Hill, I learned that, you know, in order to get a job, the best way to do that is to intern. And the majority of internships on the Hill are unpaid. While you can find some, it's very competitive no matter what. I couldn't just afford to be paying my student loans, which are in repayment now, living in Washington, D.C., working 40 hours a week, and dressing nicely, and commuting, and doing all of that, not making any kind of income. Like, that's just not a reality. And I want to stress that the student opportunity program that Catherine spoke about, while it addresses low-income students, I don't consider myself from a low-income background. I come from a middle-class family. However, my parents just cannot afford to pay for me to live here and not make any kind of income. It's not a reality for me. So, you know, you factor in all of those things, and a lot of the interns that I knew on the Hill did come from backgrounds where either their parents were able to pay for them in the time that they were hoping to buy time to get a job, or they had some sort of third-party subsidy, be it a stipend from a private source or I don't know what. But I saw that, you know, a lot of people who maybe come from my background were unable to earn internships and, you know, buy time to find a position here in Washington simply because of the financial limitations that internships, unpaid internships in Washington place on people. So I guess that's been my experience, and I would say that I think that internships, as Catherine mentioned, just to re-highlight this, you know, education is a tool that we can use to become socially mobile in our economy, and it can either reproduce social stratification by race, ethnicity, and gender, or it can be used to change those modes. And I think internships are a great tool if they were accessible to more people of different financial backgrounds.
Thanks, Cassie. Before we open it up for questions, I just wanted to add kind of a brief conclusion. So we've heard a little bit about the context of trends in access to post-secondary education and completion, the potential for government to address inequities in access to public service, and our specific proposal and a human face to the problem with internships right now. I want to add that the proposal that we're talking about today is only one piece in a broader proposal that we're putting forward to change the way internships work in our economy. By no means is this a catch-all for all of the ills that occur in our internship systems. We have to address the legality of unpaid internships and internships in general, and make sure that interns have adequate legal protections going forward. So this is just one small step in a broader internship agenda. And now we'll open it up for questions. We have a mic back there. If you could introduce yourself with your name and your affiliation, and then maybe direct your question towards one of the specific panelists, that'd be great. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Mandara Myers with the Center for Progressive Leadership. We have, for the past 5 years, run a paid internship program here in D.C. to specifically address this challenge. Alex actually got to participate in some of our trainings when he was an unpaid intern 2 years ago. And the question that I have is a little bit off topic, but I hope people understand the connection. One of the things that we're finding is that internships aren't even entry level anymore. So for students from low and moderate income backgrounds who are working their way through college, they don't have internship experience to get them internships in DC, if that makes sense. So the challenge that we face is we have incredibly talented young people who we're trying to support in getting internships here in DC, but because their resumes show that they've done service-based work or campus work study jobs that have not prepared them to do research or policy analysis, they can't actually get an internship in DC. So I'm interested in how suggestions, strategies any of you have in terms of how we both better prepare students for DC internships, but also how we start to change some of the culture in DC in terms of what counts as relevant experience in order to just be able to get that first internship. Sorry, I know it's a hard one.
No, that's fine. I mean, I'll start by saying that we should stress that if we want to fund 500,000 interns every year, we obviously aren't talking about having all of them come to Washington. I mean, this is about public service all over the country. This is your state capitals. These are your county courthouses. This is your, you know, local hospital. I mean, this is having students do public service wherever public service exists, which in America is anywhere. So I think that, you know, because we do live and work in D.C., when someone says unpaid intern, we think, oh, the Hill, you know, obviously. But we don't want 500,000 students on the Hill every year. We want public service in all aspects. In terms of how to have interns or prospective interns in D.C. have more intern experience so that they're better interns when they come to D.C., I would say that first, D.C. is a special case. and that the intern culture here we can all speak to as to how it's kind of become a part of the system of that you are the intern, every office has one, and they expect so much more out of them. Second, I think it's partly a consequence of our current economic situation that the labor market is so difficult right now for young workers that more of them are willing to work for free even with more experience that they have. And if we do have a robust recovery, if we do have strong labor market growth, we will see, hopefully see some of these opportunities that really are kind of backdoor opportunities start to dissipate. And that people will realize that in order to have qualified workers with much experience, that you will have to pay them.
I actually have one quick idea about this. There was an organization at the very beginning of the internet age, which that tried to make it possible for nonprofits to kind of post their research opportunity, research that they needed done, so that students who needed a topic for a required paper could have a chance to do something that would actually have a real impact in the real world. And it was a terrific idea, and it was sort of a volunteer slash academic slash entry into the sort of jobs world. And I think it was just ahead of its time. So that was, I always thought it would be a great way to connect people who are on campus who can't maybe afford to come and spend a semester in Washington to be able to still do some work that maybe a Washington think tank or a Hill office needed done in a way that would not take them off task of their academic work.
And just to really briefly follow up, I don't know how many people are here in the higher education community, but I think there's something to be said about institutions of higher education preparing students for internships. Like, I know as part of my major requirement when I graduated with a public policy degree was to have an internship. So, I mean, universities and colleges could push to encourage intern experiences and subsidize those as well.
Hi, my name is Tara Ellison. I'm with the Third Wave Foundation. We're a feminist foundation, and we fund organizations that are by and for young women and trans youth from marginalized communities. So I was curious if any of you could speak to how this proposal, beyond AmeriCorps, might benefit community-based organizations, especially those serving the low-income communities that these students are coming from.
Yes. So when we define public service for the Student Opportunity Program, we are looking at both, you know, any state, local, or federal government office, but also nonprofits as defined as a 501c3. And so that if there are community-based organizations that do have that tax filing status, they would be interns would be eligible to work there and receive the stipend from our program.
I just want to add a broader point kind of on societal and democratic inclusiveness that we kept coming back to when we were putting together this proposal. Kind of what we were thinking through was what sort of situation do you have? What sort of society, what sort of democracy do you have when only the people who can afford to forego wages and work on the Hill and work in these nonprofit organizations are the ones that ultimately get the jobs in public service? How does that affect our democracy and our society? And so what we're hoping in some small way is that we make our democracy and our society a little bit more inclusive, a little bit more representative, and maybe, who knows, someday that'll be reflected in the public policies that, you know, these kids go on to design. Oh, that's very idealistic.
Good evening. My name is Kevon Painter. I'm a freshman economics major from Scotts Plains, New Jersey. I go to Howard University. And I just wanted to share my story a little bit because I was actually participating in this internship program last year, which was my senior year in high school. And it was a internship program that was placed in Newark, New Jersey, where there's a lot of low income and middle class families. Well, mostly low income. And I was one of those. And if it wasn't for that program, which takes kids and it teaches them business and it teaches them and it places them in different internships around New York City and the tri-state area. Like, I was placed in Morgan Stanley for last summer, and it was a paid internship. And if it wasn't for a program like that, I would have had to work at fast food, you know. And, you know, I would not have had a resume like I have now that has something like Morgan Stanley. It would have had, you know, Arby's instead. but I forgot what my second point was, but I just wanted to thank you guys for having, like, you know, for addressing this kind of issue, because this is an issue that, you know, I've kind of taken personally, because I see a lot of kids, you know, like me, who would much benefit from this kind of experience. So, you know, one of my personal things, I want to one day become, you know, a politician and create policies like this that will create opportunity for other kids like me, because I remember when I was in that spot. So, yeah.
Great, thanks.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Peter Morris. I work for the National Congress of American Indians. I'd like to put a point to the panel and just to kind of echo some of the points that have already been made. To get to a place where we have the kind of representative group of interns and a more representative workforce that represents the diversity of America, this is about building a pipeline to the point that we have, you know, a representation of interns, and we have a representation at all levels of our various organizations. My concern in the policy, and I'm wondering how you are thinking about this, is that a frame that only applies to low-income students from a particular school and doesn't address issues, particularly around communities of color and how they're recruited into and represented in internship programs, could perpetuate some significant discrimination that exists within some of those schools. And I think it's a critical frame. It may not necessarily, I'd probably argue that you should put it in the policy, it may not necessarily belong there, but at least some way of reflecting, you know, X school is a Hispanic serving institution with 20% Hispanic students, but is only sending 1% Hispanic interns to different places under this kind of a program. What's going wrong? And I think that kind of frame is really critical to our conversations about this and also to how the policy gets enacted. And I'll also just make a really quick corollary point to that, which is I think we also need to think about the power structures that exist and the relationships that can be built between organizations here in DC and in other parts of the country, where the organizations that are able to pay for internships may, you know, maybe we should be thinking about how we build partnerships with those who can't pay. So the fact that there are unpaid internships doesn't necessarily mean that people are being mean or rude or capitalistic or whatever. It's just an economic reality for some organizations. And it's my sense that those organizations that face that economic reality are a similar set of organizations that would provide great experiences for those students from communities of color and to build that diversity of the workforce that I think a lot of us want to see.
I think that we, you know, we don't address directly in our proposal anything about, you know, specific, not necessarily quotas, but specific targeting to students of color, students of different minorities and that case. But that's one reason why it's important that the program is designed to give individual campuses the freedom to design their own program, and so that it's not too many top-down mandated requirements, but bottom up, this school can respond to its own needs. And that is the goal, and I think that we put trust in the institutes of higher education to find the students that would benefit most from this and to promote them. Whether or not that trust is misplaced is not something I would speak to with certainty before we even start a program or only speaking about it in the hypothetical. But because there are so many different campuses across the country, because they do have so many different forms and so many different student bodies, it was important to us to keep this as bottom-up as possible in that respect, and hopefully universities would do the right thing in terms of their minority communities.
I think Peter's point is an important one. I mean, one thing you could build in would be, you know, just a data keeping component so that you can see what are the effects and are there some unintended consequences in terms of how it plays out. So
the data part is actually part of our proposal, that if you were an intern, they would not only find out where you interned or keep track of where you interned, but also, you know, where your internship was, pardon me, who it was with and what your background was, and then keep track of the students for up to 5 years. That was part of the proposal.
Hello, my name is Tasha, and I work at American University, and I actually manage the Community Service Federal Work Study Program there. And so my question is around the Federal Work Study component of this and how that would work. Just so FYI, for those who may not know, universities have the option and actually obligation to a certain extent to send students out into the community to use their Federal Work Study awards. But the problem I found is the regulations around federal work study. If they're doing tutoring, then they can go out at 100%. It costs the university or the organization, it doesn't cost the organization any money. Anything else, so if they're doing things like working on policy or that type thing, it would cost the organization at least 25% of the students' wages of what they earn. And that tends to be kind of a detractor for students wanting to do this, or not students, excuse me, organizations participating in the program. And on the same hand, the university also, if the organization doesn't want to pick it up, the university would have to pick it up, as they do for any on-campus students. And so I'm a little curious as to how would that work? Would it become all 100% government funding at that point, or is that part of the proposal?
This is an excellent question because it deals with the logistics of the program. And the way that we envision it is that we want to use the work-study offices on campus and use that infrastructure that's already in place in terms of outreach with student and name recognition. But we see this as a separate pot of money that answers to different rules and different regulations. And whereas work-study, your wage is subsidized by your university depending where you work. For the Student Opportunity Program, you get $3,500, and that's all yours, and it's your stipend. You know, the university doesn't pay for some of it. The employer doesn't pay for some of it. That's money from the federal government to the student. It goes through the work-study office, but that's a lump sum to the student for their three-month or $7,000 if it's for a six-month internship.
Yeah, but in no way does that preclude universities from adding additional funding. And, you know, many universities already have kind of very small-scale stipends for internships, so we're hoping that this can all kind of be rolled together in this new office on campus. So,
hi, my name is Franny Zlotnick. I work at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. I have some questions, two questions about the broader economic impact of the use of unpaid internships. I'm wondering if anyone can speak to whether sectors that have widespread use of unpaid interns, whether there's evidence of entry-level wages being depressed by the use of non-paid labor, and what if there's any research on the effect of long-term earnings for people who spend their first years in the labor market not actually earning anything.
Okay, well, I'll just jump in again. So the industries that have that are notorious for having unpaid interns, I think we think of are things like the media, fashion, entertainment, journalism, and that is a separate issue altogether because they are for-profit institutions, and they are not covered by this program. And the legality of those interns and the effects of those interns are a separate issue. And we actually have a paper forthcoming from EPI that addresses that directly. In terms of how, you know, starting out with an unpaid internship affects your wages, I know of no research that's shown that. I do know that Lisa Kahn from Yale University has done a now notorious study that showed that simply graduating from college in an economic downturn will affect your wages on average for the rest of your working life. And it's not just that you graduated and didn't have a job versus graduated and did have a job, but the external effect of a bad labor market on your wages and your wage growth, whether or not you had a job, it doesn't matter. Because you graduated during a downturn, your wages will be lower. That would lead me to conclude that there probably is some effect on wages, but what exactly that looks like, I couldn't speak to with certainty. Yeah,
and there's additional research, kind of the flip side of that, is if you do manage to get a job in a recession or any other time for that matter that's mismatched to your skill level, your training, your education, that can impair your wage growth for the rest of your life. And, you know, has very specific implications for your wages since, you know, wages are so path dependent and sticky on the last job, last wage that you have. And it also results in kind of depreciation of, you know, your training, your human capital that you've accumulated. So even having a mismatched job can be really detrimental to your long career earning.
Hi, my name is Ryan Klang, and I work for an organization called the Washington Center for Internships and Academic Seminars, and we work with a network of about 400 colleges and universities across the country and around the world to bring students here to D.C. for internships. We were founded in 1975 and have had 40,000 students come through our program, and I'm an alumnus of our program and had decided to come back and be a fundraiser for that organization because I see the value in providing these opportunities for students and providing a level playing field for that. And we've worked a lot with the private sector to provide scholarships and stipends for support for students to intern in public sector and nonprofit internships, and have companies like New York Life, AT&T, and Comcast supporting that. And I'm just curious, in the work that and the research that you're doing, is how you might suggest engaging also the private sector has an interest in supporting this as well, and kind of how have you looked at how the private sector might be interested in supporting it?
Yeah, you know, kind of the companies that you named, the Fortune 500 companies, all have, you know, really, a lot of them have really great internship programs that involve a lot of training and kind of, you know, it's really a pipeline into high quality employment at that firm. So there's a lot that maybe this program can learn from those private sector experiences about what sort of training would be best to really funnel these students into high quality employment after graduation. And on kind of the note of these organizations that exist to place students at in internships in DC and in other cities, we see this as in no way kind of encroaching on that. And we feel like in a lot of cases, the students that would be eligible for this program might not be able to afford kind of the placement fees that are associated with, you know, those private sector placement firms. So I think this complements a lot of the work that is already out there.
Hi, my name is Cindy Morgan Jaffe. I am, my business is the Intern Lady, and so I work with both interns and businesses in setting up internships. And so I have two things to say. One is thank you very much for doing this work. It's just so needed. And I'm asking what is going to happen next. Where is this program going to be presented? What do you see as the next steps with that? And then the second part of my question is, I deal with a lot of businesses who are owners who are resistant to having interns. And this is a situation where there's a huge demand, yet there's an expectation that people are just going to be able to be placed. And there's a sort of a sense of, well, I'm just doing a nice thing for these people and so on. And, you know, you have to kind of walk them through the benefits and so on. So I know that InternBridge has done a lot of work to try to help that, and I'm just wondering in terms of those of you who've worked in the field and so on, are you met with a lot of resistance, you know, from the actual organizations themselves?
Well, on your first point, you know, this is the first step, you know, putting our proposal out there. And kind of the next part, a lot of it falls to you to start the discussion at your university, at your workplace, with your friends, with your professors, you know, with your elected representatives, ultimately. And we want to get this proposal out there and moving, not just here in D.C., but in your local communities, in your local universities. So that's one step. And we plan to partner with, you know, all these great organizations and, you know, Roosevelt to work to get this idea out there. Second point, I don't know, Catherine, would you like to address that or
I could say one thing about the second point, which is, you know, and again, the AmeriCorps doesn't work in the business sector, but the demand to have AmeriCorps slots is huge right now and way below what the president's proposal would support. So in terms of are there placements out there in those types of positions, you know, if the funding were available, AmeriCorps could double or triple easily in the next year or two.
Hi, my name's Hillary Doe. I'm the director of the Roosevelt Institute Campus Network here in DC. And for the last few years, we've been running a paid internship program as well. A couple of the components of this program, which I noticed and really, really liked, is the emphasis on, you know, community-based internships, for example. We've been moving out of D.C. and placing students in Chicago, and next year we'll place students in Detroit, and really underscoring that you don't have to come to D.C. to be successful and to be civically engaged and to do public service as a career, I think is very important. The question I had was that, you know, all internships are certainly not created equal. Getting your foot in the door, getting that on your resume in the first place, I know is important and opens a lot of doors for career paths. But we're really intentional, and a lot of great programs are very intentional about, you know, providing trainings, providing opportunities to network and get that social capital that you were talking about. I wonder how it shook out when you guys were writing the proposal about, you know, deciding to give ownership to those people placing interns and let it be a bottom-up program versus, you know, providing incentives or some frame to, you know, add a training component and things like that.
Oh, that was a huge issue that we thought about, kind of the quality of the internship. And as you said very well, you know, not all internships are created equal. So how do we place students at those really educational, really formative internships? We ultimately decided on that bottom-up approach where the internship coordinators in the work-study offices will have, you know, significant discretion in being able to place their interns at organizations. And the onus kind of falls on them to vet the experience and vet the organization. But they will have help from the federal level. Kind of one of the complementary policies that we propose is a database of internships and internship evaluations from former people who have done internships at those firms, and specifically the student opportunity program enrollees that have done internships at these firms. And in this way, we hope that, you know, when you're going to pick your position, you can consult this online database and see how many stars it got on, you know, these various metrics so that you have a better idea, and so that your placement director also has a better idea of where the real substantive internships are. So, Ross.
Hi, I'm Ross Eisenbray, EPI's vice president. I wonder if you can give us a little more context about what exists now. What does the federal government do currently? Sort of the dollar volume support for internships across the agencies? I used to work at OSHA. We had presidential management interns who were, really terrific. They were graduate level people. They were paid, pretty well for their positions. But what is there? What is there in college work study? Do you know the size of that program? How does that compare to the $1.2 or $1.5 billion that you're talking about as an annual support?
Well, Alex, you want to start?
I was going to say maybe Shirley could start us off with kind of the obligations through AmeriCorps and other similar programs.
Yeah, I can tell you, the entire Corporation for National Service budget is about $1.5 billion. So, and that doesn't just go to AmeriCorps, it supports a range of programs. And I really don't know about I know College Work Study is quite a substantial investment.
I believe College Work Study is roughly $1 billion. So ours would be about the same size, but a little bigger. But I think it averages between $1 and $1.3 billion a year in terms of work study.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of as to what internships currently exist on the federal level and how those are supported,
there's really very little data. We tried to do a back-of-the-envelope calculation to estimate how many interns really work for the government, but even then, we don't have a really good conception of how many of those are paid. We have statistics from some of these private consultancies like InternBridge that suggest that something like 60% of all, or a little bit lower, of all federal interns are paid, and then it's substantially lower for local and state governments, and then some of the affiliated agencies, sometimes as low as 20 or 30%. So it really, really varies across the government, and a lack of data is a key impediment. And in fact, one of the components of our proposal is to have the BLS start recording interns as part of their monthly current population survey, so we can get a better sense of what all is out there. I think that's it, and that's all the time we have for the presentation today. But thank you again for coming out, and thanks to all our panelists for their great presentation.